Hello, this is
Hello,
Tamara
everybody.
Zora.
Welcome
oh, there
to
you
Jordan
are.
Cross.
Okay.
I was live. Sorry, I had to wait for the thing to go live.
Sorry. Yeah, this one we're messing up because, hey, it's special.
We don't have
go
any
ahead,
music,
Alistair.
But if we did, we don't have any music, but if we did, we'd thank W.J. Pierce for creating and performing it. All right, but
yes.
welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Tamara Thorn and Alistair Cross. We have a lot going on tonight. We're doing things a little bit differently. We have someone from out of the country that we're very excited to have. But before we get into that, I'm going to turn it over to Tamara, who's going to tell you a little bit about what's going on with us.
Yeah, besides messing up the opening. Sorry about that. I thought too much time had gone by. And I apologize to our guest, but it'll make this show stand out. But I want to talk about our new thriller, Spite House. And we wrote something very nice and purple all about it, just to describe it to you. We're having a blast writing it. Snapdragon Lake, long and deep, hides in the forests of California's gold country. A famously haunted private island rises from the mists of the distant end of the lake. It's home to a notoriously evil old mansion the locals call Spite House. Wealthy heiress Emily Manchester wants to clear the island's nefarious name before she donates it to a charitable organization dear to her heart. To that end, she has invited a dozen writers to stay at the house to contribute to an anthology of fact and fiction about her ancestors' deeds and misdeeds, about the alleged ghost and other tales oft told. By night, the authors dine on gourmet food and relax with their hostess as they swap ghost stories and alternative histories. By day, they write or explore the island, the old zoo, even the closed-off wing which comprised the Manchester Grand Hotel, a famous Gilded Age spa and resort now full of nothing but shadows and mystery. Wind chimes make music on a windless night. Strange ghostly figures flicker in and out of sight. Weird calls echo through the forest. The guests at Spite House are intrigued, wondering how much is for show, how much might be real. As a huge storm brews, cutting them off from civilization, they aren't terribly worried. After all, they have food, drink, good company, and work to do. They have their own imaginations to keep them occupied. That is, until the murders begin, then no one is safe. No life is sacred. Da-da-da. Yeah.
All right. And also, I would like to add very quickly that Tamara's novel Eternity is on sale now until the 16th for 99 cents in ebook at Amazon. And Eternity is where our upcoming novel Darling Girls takes place. It's a town in California, a creepy little town. And Darling Girls will be out April 16th, so be sure to get your copy of Eternity for 99 cents and check out Darling Girls coming soon, April 16th. But enough about us. Tonight, we are joined by someone that we have been wanting on the show literally since it started. When we started this show, we made a list of people that we wanted on the show, and this guy was one of the first people to make it on our list. The reason it took us so long is because we couldn't quite figure out how to do it from overseas. It's not an interesting story. But anyway, the point is we finally got him, and we are thrilled. Ladies and gentlemen, Graham Masterton has written more than 100 novels ranging from thrillers to disaster novels to historical sagas. He has published 4 collections of short stories and has also written horror novels for children. His first novel, The Manitou, was released in 1976 and was adapted in 1978 for the film The Manitou. His work has garnered critical acclaim, including a special Edgar Award by the Mystery Writers of America and a silver medal by the West Coast Reviews. Several of his books have also appeared on the New York Times. Welcome to the show, Graham. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and it's a great pleasure finally to be with you.
Finally make it happen.
Yeah. Oh, we're so glad. You're one of my early influences. I just love your work.
Well, I sort of got into horror writing. I've always been writing horror ever since I was very, very, very young. The first time I wrote a horror story was when my parents took me to see 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the movie. With it was Kirk Douglas as a harpoonist. And I rushed home and wrote my own novel with a school exercise book about fighting with a giant squid. And I bound this book in cardboard. And it was quite horrific. There was a lot of blood and a lot of harpooning in it. And I put a cardboard cover on it and did an illustration on the front and sold it to my friend for a penny. And that was my first ever royalty. I think I was about seven years old then.
And you knew how to market at such an early age.
Yeah. I enjoyed doing that so much. I went on to write more and more books, and eventually I discovered Edgar Allan Poe and was very strongly influenced by him and started writing my own short horror stories, which I would read for my friends at school.
How old were you when you started writing horror?
Oh, probably about 9, 10, or 11. But by the time I was 11 or 12, I was writing these, as I say, these short horror stories and reading them during break times at school. But years later, I met an old school friend of mine who was working in the city in London as a financier, and he said that after I had read one of my stories to him, he hadn't been able to sleep for years. It was a story about a man who had his head cut off and walked around singing tiptoe through the tulips through his severed neck.
And very nice. Very
I love
nice.
It. I love it.
It had upset this fellow for years afterwards. So I suddenly
he can't
realized.
Get a better compliment.
Yeah.
Right.
But then so I went on to it, and I wrote at the age of about 14. I wrote a 400-page vampire novel, which sadly is lost, or perhaps luckily is lost.
Wow. It takes a lot of stick-to-itiveness to write a long novel at that early age.
I just loved it. For me, writing is like a disease. I can't stop doing it. Mm-hmm. I can't stop doing it even now. But,
I know. I went around reading or singing paperback writer from about first grade on. That's all I wanted to be.
Yes, so understand. once you've done it, Tamara, honestly, you can't do anything else. It's the best life you could have.
Yeah, it really is.
I agree with that. Yeah, but, I would totally agree with that.
I went to I was sent to an all boys school, a rather posh, in England we call a public school, which actually means a private school. But then my parents moved, and I had to leave that school and go to a mixed school where there were girls. Mm. And suddenly I forgot about Shakespeare and Byron and Wordsworth, and I became interested in Jane and Charmian and Jill. And after two terms there, the headmaster came to me and he said, "You're not paying any attention to your work. You better leave." I was expelled from school. So I had to. I was 17 then, and I got a job as a greengrocer selling vegetables. And they liked me there at the greengrocers. They wanted me to become the manager, but I didn't really see that as my future. Selling potatoes and zucchini.
So you kept on writing.
I kept on writing it. Unfortunately, a vacancy came up at the local newspaper, and I became a trainee reporter at the age of 17. And wrote. I had my own rock and roll page on the newspaper for it very shortly, and I did 4 years training as a newspaper reporter.
Wonderful.
Well, that's basically where my sort of writing skills have come from. I was taught to write by. In those days, a local newspaper would have on it as their staff old reporters from Fleet Street. You know, some of the really, really, you know, retired or semi-retired, but very, very good reporters. And what they taught you was brilliant as far as writing was concerned.
Yeah, it truly is. That was my experience too. Was journalism and started in high school, and I worked on newspapers too, and I never regretted that. That was the best training for writing
it
fiction.
It is absolutely,
too.
Tamara. It's the best possible training you can get because it teaches you to grab your reader immediately from line one, and keep the story going, which is essential. You know, for, I think for writing a non-fiction, especially horror fiction. But something else happened at the same time. Not only was I being a reporter, but I became very interested in American, first of all, in American sort of hardcore writers like Nelson Algren, who wrote The Man with the Golden Arm, and Herman Wouk. They're very, very, very good writers. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in the way they wrote. And then I sort of discovered the beat writers like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs.
Mm-hmm.
And William Burroughs came out with The Naked Lunch, which actually was the last novel to be prosecuted in America for obscenity. But I loved that book. I loved that book.
I have to ask. Alistair and I both, you know, by third grade were heavily into Sherlock Holmes. Now, as a kid in Britain, were you into Sherlock Holmes, or was that sort of we just thought it was the best thing ever?
No,
I sort of enjoyed it,
but I wasn't a great Sherlock Holmes fan, actually.
Ah.
You know, I was, by the age of about 15 or 16, I was so much into those beat writers. I just love their directness, and they were completely unafraid to say what they wanted to say. And I wrote to William Burroughs when he was living in Tangier, and he wrote back, and we corresponded for a long, long time. Eventually, he moved to London to get a treatment for his morphine addiction and lived in London. And I used to go around and visit him, you know, a couple of times a week. And we used to have dinner together. And we would talk about writing. And that was very, very important, that because he was very, very interested in writing in a way that readers felt they were actually inside the book rather than reading something on a page. And we talked about all the different ways you could make a reader hear something in the distance, feel the wind on the back of their neck, and smell and really be in the book. So, and I try very, very hard with every book I write, and particularly the horror books, to make the reader feel that they're there and they're living it. And that came from...
How do you specifically do that? Do you have any tips on that? Like, what did you...
Yeah,
like,
well, the way to do it is to be very simple in the words you use, but very precise in the words you use. But also, I write almost like I'm writing music. There's a lot of rhythm comes into it as well.
So I don't listen
to music, other music while I'm writing. I need silence because the rhythm, my rhythm is most important to get that communication and that involvement with the reader.
You're very good at involving all the senses too. That's something I really like.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're the only person who has ever given me the creeps while reading a book. Even Stephen King hasn't. It's hard. And it's in The Manitou when the old lady is floating above. I find that just really works for me.
Did you see it in the film as well?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She
yeah, I liked it in the film too. I liked the book a lot better, but I thought the film was a lot of fun. I own it.
Yeah, no, I thought Tony Curtis was quite fun.
Yeah.
But anyway,
Harry Erskine as Tony Curtis. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah, but that whole involvement with. Did come from a lot of long, long talks with William, poor old William. Allen Ginsberg turned up one evening.
Oh.
While I was around at Bill's flat, and I was what they call a mod, you know, very, very smart in those days. And I had a beautiful new pair of pale suede Italian shoes. And Allen Ginsberg came in. He was all sweaty and greasy, his long, greasy black hair. And he said, "Oh, I'm absolutely bushed." He said, "After I got jet lag, I'm just going to lie down on the floor and have a sleep." And so he lay on the floor and he put his horrible black greasy curls all over my beautiful pale Italian shoes. And regardless of his poetry, I've never forgiven him for that.
That's awesome.
You used the word mod, and my friend and I, who are closer to your age than Alistair is, we're trying to... Alistair was telling us what mod means to him, which is more the goth culture in the 80s, I guess, 90s. Can you explain?
That's how it
was in the 80s, we couldn't. We were trying to explain mod in the 60s.
Well, it was being very, very sharp. Very, very sharply dressed.
Ah.
And, you know, and just a nice narrow ties, beautiful suit. And lovely shoe all the time. We would spend most of the evening, wasn't spent with girls, it was spent pressing our trousers.
Nice.
So Maude wasn't about paisleys and miniskirts and things like that.
Oh, that was part of it as well for the girls.
Oh,
it was,
okay.
You know, it was miniskirts and and that sort of dressing.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Great. We were very fussy though, very fussy dressers.
So how cool is it though that you were able to meet these people? Were you?
I just wrote to them.
Starstruck?
I just talked to them. No. No, William was, for example, he dressed like a bank manager, and he had a sort of real Midwest drawl in the way he spoke, and he was very iconoclastic and sardonic and pornographic, of course, as well. But he was a very funny man, and we got on really, really well. We just had a good time together.
Nice. Wonderful.
I remember.
Speaking of pornographic.
Yeah. I wish we weren't, but we can if you like.
We were talking before the show, and you were telling us that you were the editor for Penthouse.
Yeah, well, this is what happened. I was on the local newspaper for 4 years doing my training, and then I tried to get a job on a national newspaper. And I went to the Daily Telegraph, which is a big national newspaper in England, and said, mm-hmm. Can I have a job? And they said, well, no, you're not experienced enough. You'll have to go up north somewhere. So Worcestershire Evening Telegraph for a few years, then you can come back and we'll give you a job. And I thought, go up north? You've got to be out of your mind. I'm not going up there. And then a girlfriend of mine said she'd seen somebody reading a magazine called Mayfair on the Underground. Which was it was a kind of rival to Playboy, a British rival to Playboy, and I wrote them a very, very arrogant letter saying I was the best thing since sliced bread, and they gave me a job.
Nice, paid off.
In fact, they interviewed me in the swimming pool of the Royal Automobile Club in Pall Mall.
Nice.
So that was all very good, but it turned out that it was only the publisher, the editor, me. Secretary and everything else, like the photography, was all farmed out, to freelance designers. But I did 4 years there, and learned an awful lot, by doing that. Particularly, what I really learned. Sorry.
You said that a surprising amount of the letters were real. I always assumed that they were written by just
the ones on Mayfair were, because we didn't get many letters. But the ones on Penthouse, we had loads and loads and loads. In fact, we had a sort of subsidiary magazine called Forum, which was a kind of sex advice magazine.
Oh, we used to read that.
Oh, yeah.
I remember.
Penthouse Forum, yes. I edited that too. I edited both magazines at one point.
Oh, wow.
But the most important thing about working for those magazines was that I got to talk to a terrible job I had to do. I had to go to the studios when the girls were being photographed for the center spread. And I had to and talk to the girls. Oh, God, that was no idea. The hardship.
Poor thing.
It must have been awful.
The girls would be being photographed sort of in between. You have no idea. And I would have to talk to them about, why they wanted to appear in the magazine, what their background was. And I would talk to them about their sex life, their boys' friends. And it gave me an awful lot of insight into the thinking, women's thinking, young girls' thinking about sex and their relationships. And that taught me an awful lot.
And, what did it teach you?
Well, it taught me how women respond to men, and it enabled me in later years to be able to write as far as a man can ever possibly do from a woman's point of view. But to go back in time a little bit, I combined that what I learned from those girls with something that I had learned the very first day that I was working on the local newspaper. I'd been sent out on my bicycle to go and interview a woman whose husband had won a cycling trophy I went out and knocked on the door of this house, and a little boy answered, and he said, "Mummy, I mean, there's a man at the door." And I was only 17, so I thought, wow. Anyway, I went, I went and interviewed this woman about her husband and his cycling trophy. He wasn't there himself, but she told me what he'd done. And then just as I was leaving, she said, "He beats me." And I stopped and I said, "Do you want to talk about it?" So she said yes. So we went back into the living room. We sat down there for over an hour. She told me how badly her husband had been behaving, how much he beat her, how if she cooked a meal that he didn't like, he would throw it around the kitchen. And she'd appealed to her sister, and her sister said, "It was your fault for marrying him." And her parents had said much the same thing. There was nothing I could do for her. I mean, really, except to say, try and seek some advice, you know, from a professional. But as I cycled away from there, I was like Saul on the road from Damascus. You know, I really suddenly thought, as a sort of sympathetic listener, if I ask sympathetic questions and listen to people, they will tell me absolutely anything and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. And that's where an awful lot of my what I put into my books, into my novels, people's fears, people's problems, people's, you know, marital difficulties, all comes from actually having really talked to people about their real problems. And they do. They'll tell you anything.
Yeah, it really shows.
Yeah, and it does. And I think that that's a really interesting point, because one of the things about your writing that we're both very fond of is the depth in which you handle your characters. I mean, these are always very, very real people. And I wonder, do you write, when you're, as far as your process goes, do you listen to the characters as in they kind of come to life for you and kind of do their own thing and you explore them and that kind of develops the plot as you're learning about them? Or do
you do
it the other way? Yeah, so you're kind of a character-driven writer.
No, you've nailed it. I'll sort of have a general idea of what the story is going to be. But as the characters appear and take on flesh and life, they guide the plot, and suddenly a new character will appear and the plot will go in a different direction. And sometimes there's a huge mess. It's like trying to make a clock with all the bits and cogs and springs and things lying on the desk in front of you. And you try and got to find a way to put them all together so it's going to tick at the end. Yes,
what
definitely.
What a great way to say it.
Do you have a favorite character that you've written that particularly stands out to you, or that you're particularly interested in?
Well, of course, Harry Erskine from The Manitou. I mean, he's probably the nearest character to me, because I tell cards as well, and I'm just as much of a fake fortune teller as Harry. telling tarot. Well, I don't do the tarot cards. I do some cards that were used in the time of Louis XIV, but they're very similar to tarot. But they're a great way of introducing yourself to girls. I'll tell your fortune. I'm going to tell your fortune. I'll tell you what your love life is going to be.
Harry's voice, it just, the first time, I've read that book numerous times because I like it so much. His voice is so fantastic. He's real. He does all the non sequiturs and all kinds of things, and you just love him to death. And he's so honest about his dishonesty. And
well,
I love that too.
I think that's that is important. Yeah, but also he had, unlike an awful lot of horror characters, he has a sense of humor.
Very and much so.
Some people, people react to horrific situations by laughing a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you'll see. Look at during the First World War. You know, they produced a newspaper for the troops called the Wipers Times, based on Ypres. And it was all full of jokes, even though they were getting blown apart all around. You know? And that's the way that people do deal with very tragic situations and very horrific situations. They laugh, and that's one of the things I did introduce into my books.
You did.
Yeah.
I love that.
And how do you feel about the movie, The Manitou, that they made? A lot of authors kind of have mixed feelings or bad feelings, but it's a great movie. How do you feel about it?
I love it.
Well, I thought Tony Curtis was absolutely perfect. He absolutely nailed Harry Erskine, and I thought all the rest of the characters were quite... I mean, the film's a bit corny, really, but... And really, the idea of a Native American being born out of the back of a woman's neck is a bit weird. But, say the least.
But you pulled it off. That's the thing.
It's a kind of phrase.
The character
is
so real. Yeah.
At the time, Star Wars had just come out, and Bill Girdler, who made the movie, was very impressed by Star Wars. So the ending is a bit more Star Wars-y than I would have liked. But I thought, you know, for the time, I think it's a fun film, and it just about caught the right note.
And you actually have some on your website. You have some. I'm not looking at it right now, but you have some Harry Erskine items and other things that are free to read online.
Oh yes, I do.
I
have my own website. You can read bits and pieces in a Harry Erskine story. I think there's one called Spirit Jump, which has been published in an anthology, but not otherwise.
Yeah,
right.
That was a treasure
trove. For the listeners, what is your website?
It's www.grahammasterton.co.uk.
All right, that's easy enough.
Yeah.
Before we continue, I just want to take a minute just to remind everybody that you're listening to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne. You can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com and tamarathorne.com. You can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com, or if you tweet, our handles are @TamaraThorne and @CrossAlistair. We also have a Haunted Nights Live page on Facebook if you want to check that out, where we update you on all the guests that are on. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. If you're listening online, please click the follow button. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC, and we are here with one of our literary heroes, Graham Masterton. And I think one of the questions that I would like to know, and I think a lot of people would too, you've lately been doing a lot of crime thrillers, which is fantastic. I love those too. But what brought that change?
A couple of things brought the change. One was that in the late 90s, horror began to really die away, not only in England and the United States, but also in France and other countries. And it was, in fact, I couldn't sell a horror novel in France for nearly 5 or 6 years. The market just lost interest. Of course, these days there's been a huge revival in horror as a new generation of readers has come up. But at the time, it was quite difficult to sell horror novels for decent amounts of money. So at that time, my late wife Ishka and I had moved to the Republic of Ireland just for a change. All our boys had grown up, and we wanted a change of scenery. And so we rented this enormous Victorian mansion, looked like a haunted house, in overlooking the River Lee in Cork. And I became fascinated by Cork. It's a very interesting... Cork is an extraordinary place. You know, you hear Irish people. You hear from Dublin. They talk in a very precise, nice sort of accent in Dublin. It's a bit different in other counties. In Sligo, they talk a bit like that. Things are going to get washed before they get better.
Better.
Before they get
better. Right?
Better. Things get wash before they get better. But you go down to Cork, go down to Cork, and you can't understand what the hell they're talking about.
Oh, geez.
You see, they speak a bit like high like that, and they speak very quick. And everybody's, no matter what age you are, if you're a man, you're a boy. How are you doing, boy? You're grand dear boy. And if you're a woman, you're girl. How are you doing, girl? Oh, fine there, grand. And the slang is extraordinary. I mean, the shopping is the messages. Go and get me the messages. Now, you get me 10 pounds of potatoes, but don't get the big ones because they're too heavy to carry.
I love it.
Oh.
You could do voice work. Have you ever done any voice work?
No, but I am now. But
right.
you do begin to speak a bit Corkinese, and I still mentally think Corkinese. A chap said to me, he said, "I saw you in Panna, but that's St. Patrick Street, which is the main shopping street in Cork. I saw you in Panna the other day," he said, "and I ran to catch up with you. By the time I caught up with you, you'd gone."
I love that accent.
The logic is like that all the time. So Cork is a fascinating place, but of course it's the second deepest harbour in the world. It was the last port of call for the Titanic before it set sail.
And because of that, over
centuries, all kinds of different invaders and people have emigrated to Cork. So it has a very fascinating history and language. People will still say, take a sconce at that, you know, like sconce, like in a candelabra. Because that's what the St. Francis Drake sailors used to say. But people say, instead of say taking a look, they'll say take a sconce at that. Anyway,
there were
two things going on there. There was this decline in horror, and there was this fascinating place to write about. So I started writing crime thrillers, but very grisly crime thrillers, because I didn't want to lose my horror audience. But I also wanted to get that much bigger audience that there is for crime fiction.
Yeah.
And I set it in Cork. And the third thing I did, based on all my experience at Penthouse, was to have a female character. She's Detective Superintendent Katie Maguire, who has been appointed Detective Superintendent to go along with the policy of giving women a better chance within the Irish police. Which causes a lot of resentment, of course, amongst all the her male colleagues, misogynistic male colleagues, who are all Freemasons and golf players, and really resent her being there. So she has to deal with misogyny. She has to deal with some really grisly crimes. And also she has a really tangled love life. And I wrote the first book there. And it was originally called A Terrible Beauty, and it was published in the United States. And did very well. And I've gone on to write more of them. In fact, I'm writing the 10th one now.
Oh, nice. Katie Maguire?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Detective Superintendent Katie Maguire.
Ah. Yeah.
No, they've
great.
They've done very well.
I love reading crime. That's fun.
But again, there is a strong horror element because I have had to read some readers complain. They say, "My God, you know, the murders in your books are absolutely horrific and grisly." And I said, "What do you think murder's like?"
Yeah. You
know, I know, right?
Yeah. What do you think
it's murder?
It's murder. People getting stabbed and chopped up and having their heads blown off, you know, and things like that. I mean. I'm not Agatha Christie. You know, in Agatha Christie, about the worst thing that happens is the bishop gets beaten to death with a badger in the bathroom, you know.
The first time we did a thriller, we had readers asking us, "Where's the supernatural stuff? Is there a ghost in this?" And we could say, "Well, there might be. Because there might be, we don't know."
Yeah, but you can do a little bit. Yes, I sometimes have a little bit of implication of there's a lot of Irish mythology. And particularly in the first book, there was a hint of some demonic presence, although it didn't really appear. But
that's so much fun.
No, I didn't want to let the horror readers down. So I've just written a new, absolute out and out horror novel.
Oh yes, Ghost Virus.
Ghost Virus, yes. Which is
tell me about that.
Ghost Virus
is coming out.
It's coming out May the 1st as a e-book, and it'll be published as a hardback in October to go with Halloween. But that's based on, I've got a girlfriend who runs a cancer charity shop, and it's all full of secondhand clothes, of course, been brought in from deceased people to be sold for charity in aid of cancer research. And I just said to her one day, wouldn't it be strange if, you know, and you suddenly put on these secondhand clothes, but the spirit of the person who had owned the clothes was still in the coat or the jacket or the jeans or whatever you're putting on, and tried to get back to life through you. And that is the basis of Ghost Virus. And my theme is, my slogan for it is, beware what you wear.
Beware what you wear.
Oh, that's very good.
It is.
But, that was really great fun to write.
I'm interested in this. You said it comes out in ebook May 1st and then the paperback for Halloween. That's interesting. I'm sure they do it, obviously, but I've never heard of that. That's interesting. Is there does that happen frequently with your books, or is that
usually the ebook comes out first. It's like the Casey McGuire books. They'll come out in time for Christmas, but the probably the hardback won't come out till about February or March. So it gives the ebook time to do a bit of sales for people who read Kindle and Kobo and that sort of thing.
Do that too. Ours usually come out in ebook first, and then within sometimes a couple months, sometimes a few weeks, the paperback comes out. I always think that's an interesting way of doing things.
Yeah.
Well, certainly. I mean, ebooks have been, as far as I can tell, it's been absolutely wonderful because it's expanded the audience. You know, instead of selling, 10,000 copies of a book, you're suddenly selling 100,000. And
it's very nice.
Well, of course, you can reach so many more people. And
Go ahead.
No, go on.
Oh, the Ghost Virus. I love secondhand stores, so this just fascinates me. You said your girlfriend has a secondhand store. Strange things come in there? Have any stories?
Inspires? It's the people. It's the customers who are strangest.
No.
Of course.
Got me.
She has a bit of a problem with them because she's very pretty, and they come slavering in and saying, and just hang around and give us a kiss and all the rest of it. So she has a bit of trouble with that.
Oh, that doesn't sound so pleasant.
Oh, there we are. No, she's quite capable. She's quite capable of dealing with it.
Yeah.
So.
Now, one of the most interesting things about you, I think, is that you have some serious talent in your family tree. Tell us a little bit about some of your relatives, your ancestors.
Well, going way, way back to middle of the 19th century, on my mother's side, there was, of course, there's this man, Robert Thorne, who was a scientist, and then there was Robert Baker, who was appointed by Queen Victoria to be her chief inspector of factories, and he was very largely involved in making sure that young children didn't work in factories in dangerous cotton mills and things of that kind. So he did a lot of good work there. My grandfather was quite a famous scientist. He was the first man to send photographs by wireless.
Oh, wow.
And he worked with John Logie Baird on development of television, and also on with Technicolor on the development of color film. So he did a lot of that sort of stuff. But on the other side of the family, I have, and I only realized this comparatively recently, my ancestors were Polish. My great-great-grandfather was a Polish wine merchant outside Warsaw. His son, my great-great-grandfather, was supposed to join the Russian Imperial Army but didn't want to, so he swam the Vistula, came to England, and married a very stupid farm girl from Essex who could only sign her marriage certificate with an X. But he became a theatrical impresario, quite a famous one, and he in the West End. And he was the manager of Dan Leno, who was Queen Victoria's favorite music hall artist. So on that side, I think I've inherited genetically a great deal of that wanting to be I think if I hadn't been a writer, I would have been a comedian. I really enjoy entertaining people, and
that's very fulfilling.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. Speaking of entertaining, you have a book just coming back out now, or has just come back out, called The Hell Candidate. I don't have a copy yet, but it sounds really timely. It sounds like something I'd adore.
I wrote that actually in 1981, because in those were days we were going to California on holidays a lot. We used to go to Rancho Santa Fe, which is a little wealthy suburb just north of San Diego. And in you probably know, I think Merv Griffin lived there. And Victor Mature, I don't know if you remember him.
My mother called him Liver Lips. She thought he was ugly. I remember that.
That's right. Liver Lips Mature. He used to go up and down the street on one of those little mobility scooters, livering his lips. But so amongst the people I met there was Neil Reagan, who was Ronald Reagan's older brother. And Neil and I became friends, and he told me an awful lot about how the campaign was going for Ronald. So a lot of the details for the Hell Candidate I got from Neil. He even gave me a promotional publicity poster for Ronald, which I've still got, one of those old ones that says Reagan Country. It's got a picture of Ronald in his cowboy hat. But I think I got the idea, supposing a presidential candidate, a Republican presidential candidate, who wasn't particularly appealing, but became possessed by the devil.
It's happened now. Oh, sorry.
Careful. There are lawyers listening.
Yeah.
But this candidate in the book becomes, you know, all a sweat before him by his extraordinary satanic influence, and he becomes president. And that's the story in the book. And somebody suggested to me, well, look, this is rather timely. Why don't we bring it out again? So it's been brought out again, and you can get it as an e-book or as a paperback.
I will be doing that.
You'll love
it. It's good timing. Yeah, it's good timing.
Yeah, I reread Dead Zone because of that. Yeah.
If you had, if someone asked you, okay, I'm going to read one of your books and only one of your books, and I'm gonna see if you know, see what kind of, you know, writer you are, but I only get to read one, what book would you tell them to read? What is the most Graham Masterton-y book out there? Or your favorite? Why don't I just ask your favorite?
The book that I've still hold very dear is a book called Trauma, and it's a book of a novel about a woman who's a crime scene cleaner. I'd read about a woman who does this in Los Angeles, because when there's been a murder, the police don't clean up the mess. You have to actually employ somebody to come around and do specialized cleaning for you, clean the brains off the curtains and things like that. And it's true, but it's a very difficult and nasty thing to deal with. And that's why you need to be, if you've got any likelihood of any of your family being murdered, make sure you're insured for getting a good cleaner. And so anyway, I wrote about based on what I'd read about this woman, I wrote a novel, quite a short novel, but about her experiences, about her how she has to deal with crime scene cleaning, and also how she has to deal with a very horrible marriage, a very misogynistic husband, and a rather nasty teenage son, and a lecherous boss for the perfume company she works for as well, part time. She gradually becomes unhinged through the course of the book because of the stresses of her life and the stresses of things. And she begins to think that people are being murdered for supernatural reasons. And she really flips. But for me, that's one of the most important books I've written in terms of the way it's written and the impact it made. I did actually get it got an award from the Mystery Writers of America.
Oh, nice. Well, I just put it in my cart. Thank you.
Yeah. And don't you find writing about things from a deeply psychological point of view like that, you know, the mind kind of coming unglued, that's fascinating. We've dabbled in that a little bit, and I think that's one of the most fun things that you can write, because it's just fun. Do you feel that way? Is it?
Oh, absolutely. It's really, really interesting. One of another good friend of mine I've made recently is a woman called Professor Sabina Brennan, she lives in Dublin. She's a sort of professional psychologist, and she deals an awful. She knows exactly how the mind works, not only psychologically, but in terms of all the chemicals that make your mind work the way it does. And I found her. She's really helpful as far as understanding how the mind works and how people get dementia. How they gradually fall apart under stress. So she's very helpful.
Yeah.
She's also very, very pretty. She has wonderful green Irish eyes. The first time I met her, I said, "You have the most wonderful green eyes." And if you've ever seen a professor of psychology melt in front of you.
Nice.
I love it.
Nice. It's the accent. You don't have an accent to you, but we're to us. You know,
yeah.
Tamara was telling me, because we have our little Skype thing open, and she's all, "I love his accent." And we do. It's very pleasant to me. It really is. It's very pleasant to me. I love it. It's very soothing.
Is it a London accent? It's the same accent that the guy that stars in Lucifer uses.
It's,
which I just love.
Well, when I was very little, I was born in Edinburgh, so when I was tiny, I used to speak with a Scottish accent.
Uh-huh.
We moved south very quickly. And this accent I have is what they call received English. It's a sort of it's the BBC accent of the 1950s.
Yeah.
It's rather dated. But the advantage of it is that it's very clear. And that most people can understand you.
Do you find it amusing that Americans are just nuts for English accents?
Yeah,
I'm fascinated by all accents. I really am, mm-hmm. And I do try and imitate them as well. Especially when I've got an American character, I try and because I'm very aware of all the huge variety of accents there are in the United States, and a huge variety of different slang words as well from one state to another.
Yeah, they do vary. Fascinating. Someone who's into linguistics told me that the American Southern accent is closer to the British accent than any other accent here. And I guess it's the soft R's. I don't know, but that intrigues me.
Some of us have a soft R's. But,
and others are hard R's.
Can we hear you say something in an American accent, and then we'll talk about writing again, I promise.
Well, it's just me.
Yeah.
It kind of depends, you know, sort of what accent you want. The real problem I have is with Polish.
Polish, let's hear it.
No, I can't speak Polish.
Okay.
But my late wife, Fiszka Wisława, was Polish. Mm-hmm. And it was really through her that I began to sell books in Poland. Because in 1989, when Poland was still communist, I had a phone call, very crackly phone call from Poland, saying, "We want please to publish Manitou in Poland." And I said, "You want to publish Manitou in Poland? Great." I said, "How much will you pay?" He said, "Well, we can't pay you money because zloty is not convertible to British sterling currency. But we can give you a religious icon or maybe kibasa, which is sausage."
Yes.
we fly you to Poland and give you Icon or Kielbasa. I said, you can't get it. No. But I told Visha while he was still on the phone that she was born in a displacement camp after the war in Germany. So she'd never been to Poland, even though her parents were Polish. And she said, we must go. You know, I'd just love to go to Poland. So it doesn't care. I don't care if it's icons or sausages or whatever. You know, let's go. So we did, and they published the Manitou in Poland. And it was actually the first Western horror novel to be published in Poland after the end of communism. So it became instantly very, very popular. At the same time, one of my more popular sex books, How to Drive Your Man Wild in Bed.
I think I had that.
which had sold extremely well in America and Britain, was published in Poland, and that was the first sort of non-medical sex book to be published in Poland after the war. It's actually in Poland they call it Magia Seksu, it's a magic sex, but huge sales.
How did it come to be that you wrote How to Drive Your Man Wild in Bed? How did that come about?
It goes back to the time I was at Penthouse. When I was editing Penthouse, Bob Guccione, who was the owner of editor of Penthouse, had just started up in New York as a rival Playboy. And so I used to go over to New York a lot in the 1970s. And when I was there, I met Howard Kaminsky, who was the publisher of Warner Paperback Library, and also, incidentally, the cousin of Mel Brooks, because Mel Brooks's real name is Mel Kaminsky.
Anyway,
I see you learn something every day. Yeah. Anyway, Howard Kaminsky said to me, he'd seen some of the things I've been writing about sex, and why don't you write a book about about sex from a woman's point of view? So I wrote How a Woman Loves to Be Loved by Angel Smith. And Angel, that was true. Angel was on the cover. She was lovely. She was there in a wet T-shirt on the cover. And the book sold enormous, huge sales. It was great. And I wrote a couple of Angel Smith books, but then I started getting fan mail. And some of the fan mail started getting a bit disgusting. I won't go into it. But so I said, I'm not doing this anymore. Next sex book I'm going to write under my own name. So I wrote How to Drive Your Man Wild in Bed. And it was published by Signet Books. And again, they sold 500,000 copies in 6 months. And overall, and then I continued writing sex books, and then later on for Pinnacle Books. But after a while, Andy Essinger, who's the editor at Pinnacle Books, rang me up and he said, Graham, he said, the bottom has fallen out of the sex market.
Ironic.
So I said, but Andy, you have a contract with me. And I said, you've got to publish something. But I have a book which I'd written in about 6 or 7 days called The Manitou, which was based on Visha being pregnant with our first child, and a story about Native American spirits, which I'd read in the Buffalo Bill Annual 1955 when I was a boy. And I'd combine the two, you know, as a reporter does, combine the two stories and made the story of the Manitou. And so I sent him the Manitou, and they published that, and sort of the rest is history.
Wow. What an interesting...
I remember...
Interesting start.
But in the Manitou, the shaman, Indian medicine man, is called Dennis Klamathis, and Harry Erskine calls him the Mixed Master, and it still cracks me up.
Yeah, I don't think that was... Bill Girdler put
that in the movie.
I don't think I said that.
Oh, okay, but I like that too.
Yeah, no, that was funny, but no, that did very well. And the good thing about the interesting thing is, and this is like a lesson I'll give to anybody who wants to write a horror story, is the reason it sold so well was because it was about a demonic threat that nobody had ever written about before. You know, everybody starts writing about vampires and werewolves and zombies, but nobody had ever written about Native American mythology. And it was not only popular, you know, amongst the colonists, all you colonists, but it was very popular with the Native Americans as well. And Sitting Bull's granddaughter, as a mark of thanks, took me to lunch and gave me a framed picture of Sitting Bull. And I bet you can't guess where she took me. She took me to the Russian tea room on 52nd Street in New York.
Of course.
Naturally.
What a strange place that is. I've been there too.
The food's good. It's not cheap though.
Yeah. No, no. You always have to go if your editor takes you or.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right.
But that's in
I
fact
wonder
how,
why
how,
you. In your, with all that you've published in the years that you've been doing it and all the books that you have out, what do you consider your greatest success, or maybe was there something that you said, okay, I've achieved what I wanted to achieve?
Well, you go through various stages of wanting to do things. It was like I made a career mistake, really, because The Manitou came out about the same time as Salem's Lot. And Stephen King went on writing horror. I wrote 3 or 4 horror books, which sold very well. But then I thought I'd like to write one of those great big dramatic historical sagas, and I'd like to write a political thriller and all kinds of, you know, I just wanted to vary what I was doing. But I should have stuck with my horror audience and carried on building up the horror audience like Stephen King did. And I kind of, for a few years, I lost that audience. So that was a career mistake. But you know, I don't regret it, because I wrote a lot of the historical sagas. I loved doing them. I wrote one about oil tycoons.
Well, that's interesting. It's interesting that you feel that way, because you are, by any standards, pretty much you're a horror icon. So
you're royalty.
You are. I don't know why you would feel that way. I think that. I think that you're right up there with. I mean, it's like I said, you were one of the first people we wanted to get on the show. It's
right.
Yeah, but you know, it's my job, you know. But I like doing different things.
Historicals. I love historicals. What
historicals?
Kind?
Well, I wrote about 10 of them. Rich, Maiden Voyage, which was about an ocean liner. I wrote Solitaire, which was about diamond mining. And all kinds of historical, and they all, practically all of them, made it into the New York Times bestseller list, so they did well.
Oh, nice.
And I wrote political thrillers as well, and disaster novels. And I love a good disaster novel.
They're fantastic.
Yeah.
Plague.
Isn't it great being able to write different things, though? I mean, wouldn't it be hard year after year after year writing? I mean, you know, it's probably a good thing. I think it's good to explore and expand.
Oh, absolutely. I'm exploring new things now, you know, particularly now I've got in with Sabina Brennan, the psychologist. You know, I'm thinking of doing some books that are much more psychological. And I'm looking forward to doing those. And I could sit looking at her green eyes forever. So that's
You need to work, though.
I had lunch with her just yesterday. She came over from Dublin yesterday to see me, so we had a good lunch.
Nice.
Because I live on Epsom Racecourse, which is where they run the Derby, which is a very attractive place to be. And Epsom Racecourse has the only pub on a racecourse, I think, in the world. And we just had a lovely lunch overlooking the racecourse. Well, she was looking at the racecourse. I was looking at her eyes.
We got to see these eyes eventually. You've talked them up now.
You can actually, if there's a picture of Sabina on my Facebook page, so you can see her there.
All right, we're going to check it out.
We are
just about out of time. So could you tell the listeners where they can find you on Facebook?
They just put my name, Graham Marston, on Facebook, and they can find me there.
All right, and And can you tell us one more time what your website is so we can check you out there?
Yes, it's www.grahammasterton.com, all strung together in lowercase, .co.uk. www.grahammasterton.co.uk. And you're more than welcome, and especially welcome on Facebook as well. And anything, I always answer every morning. I get up and I answer all the queries and things that I've got, so nobody gets ignored. Because,
right.
As I said, I've said over and over and over again, people say, "Oh, we're your fans." I say, "No, you're not. I'm not Justin Bieber." You know, you're...
not Justin Bieber.
I thought that was a bad pun.
And we're
for
glad
a second,
about
yeah.
that. We're very glad that you are not Justin Bieber.
I said, you're my readers, and more importantly, because you've read my books and you've got back to me and talked to me about them, you're my friends. And that's how it works.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's well, we're glad that you're not Justin Bieber. We wouldn't even know what to say to Justin Bieber, so
no,
we'd much rather have you. So.
We hope he'll come back again.
Oh, I'd love to.
We do.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it's been fun, and you're welcome back anytime. Mm-hmm. Be in touch, and when you have something coming out, let us know, and we'll happily do it again.
That's terrific.
Yes, anytime.
It's been so nice to meet you, and to everybody listening.
Thank you
for listening.
All right. Thanks, everybody. This is Thorn and Cross, Haunted Nights Live, and we don't have any music because we're in a different studio, so over and out. We wish you haunted nights.
And sweet screams.
Thank you for listening.
Good night, everybody.